This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The National Football League is far and away the number one sport in the country and maybe the most difficult to cover. Access to coaches and players is strictly limited. Team executives may or may not return your calls. And it's been a very long time since George Plimpton made fun of himself and got an inside view when he put on shoulder pads and a helmet to play at being quarterback for the book Paper Lion. And when Wall Street Journal writer Stefan Fatsis decided to try an updated version of the same gambit, just about everybody told him that he would have no luck in what many refer to as the no-fun league. But the Denver Broncos bought into the idea and brought a 43-year-old one-time soccer player into camp as an extra place kicker, and he joins us to talk about it in just a moment. Later in the program, rediscovering the old rhythms of cross-country travel by rail. But first, if you have questions about what actually happens inside the locker room, a training camp, on the practice field, or about a midlife dream to compete with the best in the game, give us a call. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Joining us now from the studios at Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul is Stefan Fatsis. His new book is called A Few Seconds of Panic. A 5'8", 170-pound, 43-year-old sports writer plays in the NFL. And Stefan, nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Hey, Neil, it's great to be here.
And I know that inside look was important to you and a very difficult one to get as well, but that wasn't the only important part to you.
No, it wasn't. I really wanted to understand what it's like to be an athlete. I spent a year getting into shape before I even had a team commit to let me come to training camp. I found a kicking coach near my home in Washington, D.C., and a guy that had kicked intercollegiate football at West Virginia for many years ago, and who was my age, as it turned out, and still held school records and very inspirational guy. So I wanted to become competent. I wanted to see if it was possible for someone in his 40s to become something approaching an athlete.
And certainly you were more than ready to make fun of yourself, but nevertheless, you didn't want to humiliate yourself either.
No, because I think credibility is everything. Results matter in pro sports. And I really believed that the only way that I could gain the trust of the players was to show them that not only was I trying and that I was serious about trying to learn to kick and kicking, that I could be good. They wanted me to be good. And I think that mattered in terms of how much access I could get and how much they could trust me.
Yeah, they all knew you were a reporter, that you were writing a book.
Absolutely. That was the first day I walked into the locker room, and I describe this in the book. I discovered that my locker is in the quadrant with the offensive linemen, and these guys are rather big, and I am rather small comparatively. So I had to tell my story time and time again to the players to introduce myself, but they actually seemed to like the idea. When I explained to them I really wanted to understand what it was like to play in the NFL, not to understand it, you know, in the way that a daily beat reporter tries to. What did you do yesterday? Who's going to play on Sunday? What went wrong here? But to understand their inner lives as athletes, they appreciated that.
And because you weren't a beat reporter, because you didn't publish anything about your experience until the book came out, well, you know, they weren't reacting to what they saw in the paper that morning.
Absolutely. There's a tremendous divide between reporters and athletes, and some of it is absolutely understandable. I mean, I tend to view it as sort of two separate worlds. On one side, you've got everybody observing what the athletes do and critiquing it in real time. And on the other, you've got the athletes themselves, and they're not that concerned with real time. They're concerned with their own performance. They're concerned with doing well. They're concerned with understanding their jobs and doing their jobs properly and, you know, learning the playbook and watching themselves on video and improving their technique. But they don't really care what's written about them on a daily basis. They're not that sensitive to it because in the pressure-filled world of the NFL, it's not relevant to their day jobs. They're worried about maintaining a job and making a team.
Yet you did go through the experience where one of the players certainly had to be involved in what was being written about him and what was being described. He was tested positive for use of ephedra and got suspended for 4 games, which is a big deal.
And it was a big deal, and it clearly affected his relationship with me. I mean, the last thing a player needs, and this is a punter named Todd Sauerbrunn, who had been brought to Denver the year before I got there and had been in trouble before in Carolina and in Chicago, his previous stops in the NFL. Obviously, you don't want a guy running around with a reporter writing everything down as soon as you've been suspended, but that was the bargain. And in the NFL, when an owner and a coach say something is okay, And in this case, letting a writer chronicle a summer with the team, well, then it's okay and there's not much you can do about it. It didn't mean that he had to talk to me, and it didn't mean he had to be nice to me, but there was nothing he could do to stop me.
Well, he apparently made it a habit not to be nice to anybody, but you aside, there was also the case of, well, you know, the fact of the matter is that he was under enormous amounts of stress. His job was on the line. His livelihood was on the line. And indeed, this incident did prove to be a problem for him.
Absolutely. And it sort of magnified the reality for all the players to me. I mean, here was a guy who was extremely competent at punting. He had accumulated a couple of two or three years in which he was by far and away the best punter in the NFL and had approached some historical numbers in terms of his punting ability. But you only get so many chances. I mean, the NFL and other sports, if you're good, you get brought back. Mike Shanahan, the head coach of the Broncos, didn't immediately cut Todd Sauerbrunn when he tested positive for ephedra, because he knew that he had to evaluate which was worse, which would do more damage to the Broncos, the reputation of the team by keeping a recidivist troublemaker, a guy who had just been suspended, or the impact on the field in terms of punting.
2 years ago, Stefan Fatsis said just about this time of the year was headed out to Colorado to attend the summer training camp of the Denver Broncos. And yes, those two-a-days, all of those experiences, if you'd like to talk to him about it, what it was like on the inside, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And Stefan, it was interesting. You're talking about Sauerbrunn. When he was talking to team officials, he would say, well, he took the drug for one reason. When he got up to apologize to his teammates, he actually came clean.
Yeah, he did. And he came clean, which meant that he admitted that he took the drug to give him more endurance, to give him more energy while weightlifting. His initial story was that it was for dietary reasons. And Mike Shanahan, when I talked to him, the head coach, Shanahan said, come on, dietary reasons, give me a break. And that was, I thought, a high degree of candor for an NFL coach talking to a writer.
A lot of people, by the way, and you document this in the book, would have said the last coach in the NFL who would have agreed to your attending as sort of an amateur kicker would have been Mike Shanahan.
And that was the reason I didn't call the Denver Broncos initially. I spoke with about 20 teams before I got to the Denver Broncos. The owner of the Broncos, however, is a guy named Pat Bowlen. And Pat Bowlen has been very active on ownership issues with the NFL, one of the leaders in negotiating with the television networks for these $3 billion a year TV deals that define the league, really. And when I called Bowlen, he said, you know, that's something I might consider. He liked the idea of exposing what he considers and what is, frankly, a model franchise in the NFL. He funds it to the max. He provides great amenities. He gets along well with the players. And he had to get it past Mike Shanahan first. And like you said, Shanahan is a controlling figure with this team, not very open to the media, not very exposed. And when I first met with Mike Shanahan in his office, I asked him, why are you letting me do this? And he said, I liked the idea that you wanted to play, that you weren't just asking the way most reporters ask for access as a writer, inside access, something special. You were willing to go put the pads on and get out there.
And get out there. And the two-a-days, even for a kicker, and there are a lot of kicker jokes, we can go through those too, but even for a kicker, this is grueling stuff.
It's tiring. Grueling for a kicker may be stretching it, and I would hate for any other NFL player to hear a kicker complain. It's Jason Elam, the kicker on the Broncos, said to me, the one thing that as a kicker you should never do is stand out, and the other thing you should never do is complain, because what the players at other positions go through is absolutely devastating to them physically and emotionally. It is grueling. You're out there for 6 hours a day playing, and they're playing for 6 hours a day. You're at the facility for upwards of 15 hours a day, from 7 in the morning when players are often required to come in to get treatment for their injuries until 9:30 or 10 at night when meetings end. It's a debilitating several weeks.
800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. Stefan Fatsis' book is A Few Seconds of Panic. And Richard joins us on the line. Richard calling us from Jacksonville in Florida.
Yeah, I'd like to ask the guest if he had any further difficulty, bonding or communicating with the team, being that he chose to go out for a already marginalized position that's kind of made fun of at training camps as a kicker. They're often off on their own, joking around. They don't seem to work as hard on the field during training camps as some of the other positions, and how that affected his analysis and collecting his information.
I actually think it helped. It was a goof to them that this graying guy was putting on a helmet and trotting out on the field. You know, they called me Martin Grammatica after the notably diminutive kicker. They kind of treated me like a mascot initially, and I think that broke some of the tension, and it served as sort of a happy diversion. And I think that's another reason that Mike Shanahan agreed to do it. He knows that the training camp is a grind, and he saw that this could be something that the players accepted and had fun with. And being a kicker, for me, was the only thing I could do. I'm 5'8", and when I started this project, I was 160 pounds. So I couldn't strap it on and bang heads with these guys. I would have been hurt pretty badly.
Well, kickers are kind of known as oddball characters anyway, and that was probably helpful.
Yeah, having one with a notebook probably wasn't all that crazy.
Yeah, exactly. I was just another weirdo kicker. The first day I was there, the kickers got together, and we sort of jogged over to our field because we had our own field where we did our thing, and somebody screamed, "How many kickers do we need?"
Somebody also screamed, knowing that you were writing a book after your first effort at kicking that was exposed to the public, that the name of your book should be "The Worst Kicker Ever."
That was actually a TV announcer, and I would love to challenge him to go try to do what I did. It's very easy for the media to make fun of athletes. I'll never criticize a kicker for missing a field goal or a basketball player for missing a jump shot. What they do requires incredible amounts of concentration and precision and obsession and dedication, and I am far more sympathetic to athletes under pressure than I ever would have been had I not done this.
Richard, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it. The NFL record for a field goal is 63 yards, and the Broncos' Jason Elam holds that record. We'll talk more with Stefan Fatsis about working with some of the NFL's greatest players and take more of your calls, 800-989-8255. You can also send us email, talk@npr.org, or check out our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking with Stefan Fatsis, who made the unlikely journey from ink-stained to mud-stained wretch, spending an NFL training camp and preseason as a place kicker for the Denver Broncos. His new book about his experiences is called A Few Seconds of Panic, a 5'8", 170-pound, 43-year-old sports writer plays in the NFL. If you'd like to read an excerpt from it, you can go to the Talk of the Nation page at npr.org. And Stefan is with us today from the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. And let's get Richard on the line. Richard's calling us from Ann Arbor in Michigan.
Yes, Stefan, my question is, how much does emotion play into the regular season? I mean, when I was in high school football, obviously I hit the hardest when my coach had me worked up, even a little bit of college ball where I wouldn't get paid. It's all emotion. But in the pros, where their skill level is so high for the regular season games, do you think emotion plays into it, or are they just, you know, lockstep their talents there, and that's the way they play every weekend?
That's a terrific question, and I do think that emotion plays a role. You talk to players about how nervous they get in the week leading up to games, and they confess. It is incredibly, incredibly stressful. Look, every play, whether it's practice or a game, could be the last play for an NFL player. The physical risks are that great. But they love playing on Sunday. That's what makes it all worthwhile. All the stress and the pressure and the berating talk from coaches and the lack of communication from upstairs to the player to know where he stands vis-a-vis the team. Sunday is what matters, player after player told me. And if you don't get pumped up for Sunday, then there's something wrong. You shouldn't be playing the game. That's what John Lynch, the great defensive back for the Broncos, told me.
What's the difference in your experience from you kicked a lot on that training field and then going in and kicking with the team? Obviously, that rush of adrenaline, does it help or does it hurt?
Well, it should help. but in a perfect world, it would have helped me. But it didn't. I never was more nervous in my life than the morning that Mike Shanahan, the head coach, said that field goal was on the practice schedule that day. It was the first time in training camp that field goal was on the schedule. Jason Elam did his kicks, 10 kicks, and then I thought, I'm done. I'm not going to get a chance. And I had been just thinking about this. I'd been breathing heavily, hyperventilating. I started sweating. I couldn't control my emotions. I couldn't really process what I was supposed to do. And I had been doing great in warm-ups. I was hitting 35 and 40-yard field goals. And then as the reality dawned on me, I'm going to have to go out there maybe and do this. The panic grew and grew and grew. And then it deflated because Mike Shanahan, practice ended, Jason made his kicks, and that was it. But then Shanahan called us all to the middle of the field and said, there's a lot of pressure put on kickers, and we're going to put some pressure on Stefan right now. If I make a field goal 30 yards, they'll cut 30 minutes off of meetings that night.
Oh, my.
30 minutes off of meetings is valuable in training camp when you're there for 14, 15 hours a day, let me tell you.
And how'd you do?
How did I do? Well, I was not able to shut it all out. I was not able to forget that there were 1,000 fans watching and 90 other players standing, you know, 5 or 10 yards away. And I'm not talking about the guys who were on the line or the full staff of the Broncos, all the coaches and front office personnel and ball boys and equipment guys. I kind of forgot everything that I had trained my body to do the previous year. And my first kick was a disaster. It went under the crossbar.
Oh, well, you did have a triumph later, though.
I did get a second chance. I got a second chance that day, and I missed it again. And in a way, it was utterly humiliating, as you heard me say at the top of the show.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also it was also for the players. It helped reinforce in their eyes what I could learn from being there. To them, it was a big validation of what they do. They all came up to me afterward and said, now you know. Now you know what it feels like. That pressure you felt, multiply it by 25 or 50 or 100, and that's what we go through
every
play of practice, every play of every game.
Wow. Richard, thanks very much for the call.
Could I ask one quick one more?
Sure, go ahead.
Yeah, Stefan, from what you're telling me then, is like in the Super Bowl this year, maybe the Giants won because the coach was able to bring out the right emotion. Maybe there's no difference in the skill level of the coach at coaching. He just can whip the boys up like in high school.
You know, the players are pretty grounded. They know what they have to do. I mean, it certainly helps to be in these big situations because they know that they have to perform, but they get nervous like the rest of us. The best ones are the ones that are able to home in on the task at hand, to not lose focus, but to channel that energy and that passion to do their job even better than they've been trained to do it.
And Richard, besides, everybody knows that the Giants were able to win that Super Bowl game because of the purity of my support for them.
Also because of the skill of their kicker in the Green Bay game.
That's right.
All right.
Thank you very much, Richard.
Yeah.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can get Rich on the line. Rich is calling us from Syracuse, New York.
Thanks, Mike. I want to ask you, Stefan, you know, typically, I mean, football players, there's a lot of stereotypes that we attribute to football players. And I was just wondering if your personal experience that you had, you might have found any of those stereotypes that you could find as being maybe not so supported through your experience. I was thinking particularly just players' appreciation for history of the league and knowledge and appreciation for players that went before them that really did a lot to give them the opportunities that they've got today. I was wondering how
We're all, for example, aware of the case of the retired players who say their pensions are utterly inadequate, the players who played 30, 40, 50 years ago. What do you think, Stefan?
I had a conversation with an offensive lineman named Adam Meadows, who had a long career with the Indianapolis Colts, a starter. He was injured, had shoulder surgery, had to give up the game, and then 2 years later couldn't stay away and came back to the Broncos to try a comeback. And Adam and I had a talk one day, and we were just sitting down, and he said, you know, it's absolutely disgraceful that the people that came before me and didn't enjoy the giant salaries that are common to players who succeed in the NFL, because it's by no means common that everybody's wealthy in the NFL, believe me. But he said it's a disgrace. Every player should have medical coverage, should be taken care of if you've been in this league for a certain number of years, because you're guaranteed to have long-term disabilities. I found the players to be very, very thoughtful. You know, maybe not in terms of specifics going back to the 70s and 60s and 50s to the legacies of the NFL, but certainly to the players that came directly before them and to the players that they watched when they were kids. Absolutely. These are a thoughtful group of grown men, I think, defying the stereotype that these guys are dumb, because you can't be dumb to play professional football.
Yeah. I don't want you to violate any HIPAA laws here, but I was just wondering, trying that particular position, how many groin strains did you have over the course of your experience?
That's a great question. I had a groin strain pretty much all summer. I also had a strained hip flexor all summer. And nothing gave the players more joy than to watch me put bombs on my legs and wrap myself in ace bandages. They thought it was the funniest thing that I cared enough to actually do that, or that I was so frail that I would require such medical treatment, even though I was just a kicker.
Thanks very much, Rich.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
So long. Everything's recovered by now, do you think, Stefan?
I am back to normal. Yes, my groin feels fine. Thank you.
Let's go to Karsten. Karsten with us from Clarkston in Michigan.
Hi. Well, thanks for taking my call.
Go ahead.
Let me say, if I may first, that Melissa Block has the best voice on NPR.
I take exception to that, but go ahead.
But the question
I'll thank on behalf of my wife, though.
The question I wanted to ask was, did your experience in any way mirror what we saw in the movie Invincible, which is kind of the only exposure I've had to NFL training?
I thought it'd be more like Rudy, maybe. But
I think Rudy is more like it. Actually, when I finally made a field goal, the players sort of mockingly started chanting, Rudy, Rudy, and they picked me up on their shoulders. You know, not for me, because the players knew that I was, you know, they weren't going to hit me or make me go through a real sort of mean hazing. I was sort of half mascot and half teammate. By the end of the summer, I think I was full teammate. Nobody blanched when I was there. Nobody cared that I was taking notes. And the players forgot that I was a reporter. It's certainly not as dramatic as Invincible, where guys are sort of pummeling the rookie or the outsider to the ground. Right. In my case, it was more of a goof that I was there. But they also understood that I was trying as hard as I could.
Yeah.
Thanks,
okay,
Kratz.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. You mentioned going inside the locker room. Even a cursory visit inside a baseball locker room, which I've done a fair amount of, and a sport which involves a great deal less violent contact than football, just seeing the number of scars from operations on shoulders and knees, and these, of course, in the days when a lot of those operations, the scars are tiny, but these the amount of, well, medical procedures that these players go through is astonishing.
It is astonishing, and it's a given among the players. I mean, one player said to me one day, you're always hurt. Some things are bad enough that require treatment and require you to go into the training room. Others, you just walk off. I think the players felt that it was harder to overcome a coach's perception that you weren't playing than it was to overcome an actual nagging injury. There was one day in the locker room when I asked a player how he felt. And he said, you know, the little stuff hurts the most. And it began this sort of round table among the offensive linemen where they went around saying, oh, yeah, the thumbs. Wow, you get your thumbs caught in the jersey and they get bent backwards and they get bent out of shape. And then one lineman called over to another lineman and said, hey, Benny, hold up your hands. And he held up his hands and it was just like 10 gnarled fingers, none of them pointed in a straight line.
And you would have thought that the ruptured ACL might have been the topic of conversation. It's the little things that hurt.
It is the little things that hurt, and they learn to just to live with it. I mean, that's the bargain that NFL players make. They know that they are putting their bodies at risk in hopes of landing the contract lottery, or just in hopes of continuing to do what they've been trained to do their whole lives, to play football, because they like it. They don't like the business very much, and they don't like the sort of the workplace environment very much, but the games they love.
Yet they also know, and they are quite aware of it, as you describe in your book, this is training camp when a lot of people are being cut, let go, fired, dismissed, that they are replaceable, that they are, in a sense, pieces, and sometimes they would regard themselves as just pieces of meat.
And I think that hurts them more than anything. The players often said to me that what they were really looking for was a little bit of compassion and a little bit of communication to help them get better as players. And usually what they ended up with was a lot of paranoia. It's not the most progressive work environment. And it's that they accept the fact that you can get cut at any time in the NFL because there are no guaranteed contracts, unlike in the NBA or Major League Baseball or the National Hockey League. That's part of the deal. They don't like it, but it's part of the deal. Within that, though, the players sort of lament that it's not a healthier environment. They just want to be able to talk a little more openly. And that surprised me a lot, sort of the depth of thinking about these issues that we might not associate with NFL players.
Yet also, do they accept that this is a meritocracy? The person who is best will play.
Sort of, because everyone is good enough to play. Almost everybody was good enough to play in the NFL the summer that I was there. One notable exception, yes. Yeah, well, me, right. There was another guy there who was born in the Congo and was there as sort of an exchange program as the NFL tried to seed players from other countries into the league. He was definitely not good enough to play in the league right at that moment. But they don't view it as terribly meritocratic, frankly. They compare themselves to each other constantly, not in each other's presence in the locker room, but with their buddies when they're away from the facility. And it's in many ways a crapshoot. There was one player that I spent a lot of time with named Kyle Johnson, an extremely distinguished, thoughtful fullback for the Broncos, who really was incredibly contemplative about the sport of football and what it had done to him as a person. And this was the season after I was with the team. He was in the starting lineup. He was kept out of the last preseason game, which is what they do with all starters. And then the next day he was cut. And it was sort of stunning to everybody that this had happened.
So capricious, so arbitrary, and nobody ever says why.
No, they don't. You usually don't get much of an explanation. The Broncos were, I learned, sort of an exception. The general manager of the team at the time I was there, Ted Sundquist, was his name. And whenever he cut a player, Ted would make a point of explaining in detail why he was being cut. And he'd even call the player's agent to explain what the team felt were his shortcomings in training camp. Other teams, that doesn't necessarily happen. The problem that the players felt was that there wasn't enough of that while training camp
was underway.
Where
it was the coach and not the general manager was making the decisions.
Yeah, exactly.
We're talking with Stefan Fatsis about his new book, A Few Seconds of Panic, a 5'8", 170-pound, 43-year-old sports writer plays in the NFL. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Matt on the line. Matt calling us from Lawrence, Kansas.
Hi, I actually have two questions for you. The first one is, did you become a Broncos fan through this experience?
It's hard to describe myself as a fan. I grew up in New York. I was a fan of the Giants. When you've been inside a place, I root for the players that I know. I root for the organization because I like Mike Shanahan and respect him tremendously as a coach. I'm very fond of Pat Bowlen, the owner, for giving me the opportunity and because we got along very, very well. I didn't live and die with whether the team won, though. I was more concerned about what happened to my friends on the team, to the players. And I found that that's sort of how players feel, too.
Yeah.
I think it's fans and media sweat the losses a lot more than athletes do. Athletes got to have to move on. This is their job. There's going to be another game next week. And if not next week, there's another chance next year to make the team. They don't live and die 1,000 deaths the way that fans do and the media does.
Your other question, Matt?
Well, my other question was, well, I'm a Broncos fan and was shocked. I usually switch between talk radio, sports radio, and NPR, and to hear Broncos talk on NPR was a first. But
don't hold your breath.
As a fan, it seems like Shanahan came in with a reputation for being a genius and obviously won two Super Bowls pretty quickly. And, you know, I get the sense that he feels that he can, if people would just sort of get on his program, they'd keep winning Super Bowls. He's just a perfectionist who seems to have experienced some success. But I wondered, just being with the players, is there a time when they tune him out or feel like he's got his idiosyncrasies, or are they all sort of on board? Do they sort of feel like, you know, if we could just do what Mike Shanahan wanted us, if we could execute what he wants us to do, we would succeed. We'd be successful.
You know, the players really, really do respect Shanahan that way. I went into a quarterback's meeting room one day between practices, and we were talking about Shanahan, and Bradley Van Pelt, who was the backup at the time, said he's a mad genius. And the players really, really respect his football intellect. Bradley described being in a meeting with Shanahan one day, and Shanahan was diagramming a play that was occurring on a video terminal. And he had his pointer, and he just went boom, 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 and dissected, you know, 20 or 30 things that were happening at once. His football acumen is unsurpassed in the NFL, I think. Does that make him a great manager? The players would argue yes and no. And there's certain things about playing for Mike Shanahan that players love. It's a relatively humane practice environment. They know they can trust his football thinking. They trust his workout plans. On the other hand, there was a lot of questioning of play calling, a lot of questioning of which direction the team was taking in the season after I was in training camp.
Thanks for the call, Matt.
Yeah, thank you.
And Stefan, thanks very much for being with us today, and kick 'em straight.
Thank you, Neil. You too.
A Few Seconds of Panic is the name of the book. A 5'8", 170-pound, 43-year-old sports writer plays in the NFL. Author Stefan Fatsis joined us from Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul, Minnesota. Coming up, we're trying not to remind you that gas is still at $4 a gallon or more in a lot of places. So instead, we'll talk with travel writer Catherine Watson about the romance of train travel across the United States. That's next. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.